I've been in Holden now for 2 days, and I've been anxiously awaiting the time when I could officially say something. My name is John Shelley, and I teach in the religion department at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. I do not claim to be an expert in economics or in matters of justice, but I come as one who has struggled with economic issues as a part of my own Christian faith and what that faith, what the substance of that faith is in terms of how I ought to live as a human being and how our society ought to be structured. I have developed at Furman with one of the economists, a course that we team teach about every other year in economic justice. And it has so a good bit of material that I'm going to be drawing from over the next 2 weeks sort of comes out of that. I wish my co-teacher could be here. She always keeps me honest on the economics matters. Now, what I want to do today and tomorrow, Elmer asked all of us on the teaching staff to plan something of a series, but each little 55 to 60 minute session should be self-contained. And so what I'm going to do today and tomorrow is not directly related to economics, but it does serve to set a kind of foundation for some things I want to do Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And then next week, the focus is going to be fairly specifically on economic justice for all, which is the latest draft of the Roman Catholic Bishop's letter on economic justice. Now, the Lutherans have a letter, the Presbyterians have one, the United Church of Christ has one. This is the one that's really gotten the attention of the national press. And we can talk next week maybe why that's the case. But I'll be drawing from some of the other letters next week as well as this one. Now, what I want to do today, seek simplicity and mistrust it. The title of this little teaser is from Alfred North Whitehead. Whitehead is a 20th century mathematician, physicist, and philosopher who has been quite influential in some areas of contemporary Christian theology. And Whitehead, this little aphorism, seek simplicity and mistrust it, was originally sort of directed at some of his scientist friends who thought that science and mathematics could encapsulate all of reality. And Whitehead sort of devoted his life to showing that reality is far more complex than that. And in fact, if you read some of Whitehead's materials, Process and Reality, it is too complex. I bogged down. I don't think I ever finished that book, even though it was assigned in a couple of my classes. But seek simplicity and mistrust it. Now, one of the issues when I deal with a church group or with a class at Furman with issues related to economics, the things that always get in the way are certain cliches. In other words, people come in with a kind of fixed view of things, and they have these little cliches that they throw out, and these serve as a kind of moral argument for them. And so I quickly learned that one of the first things one has to do is to kind of sit down and find out where we're coming from. Now, we live in a world that seeks simplicity. Daily we're bombarded with all kinds of cliches. We find this in advertising, bumper stickers, and t-shirts. When I was sort of getting some examples to use in this presentation. I didn't have any trouble. One day I was out on my riding my bicycle, and there was a little country church that had a marquee. And in South Carolina, there's a real battle between the fundamentalists and the liberals in the among the Baptists, much like that split the Missouri Synod Church some years ago. And one of the church marquees said, to believe only parts of the Bible is to call God a liar. And then a number of the churches in town have distributed bumper stickers to their congregation that read, "The Bible says it, I believe it, that says it." Now, these kind of cliches that oversimplify reality. One related that I saw just recently, sort of related fairly directly to economics. There was a bumper sticker on a pickup that said, "I fight poverty, I work." Now, there's a whole point of view that's hidden in that little cliche. Well, often such cliches are harmless and even fun when we recognize them as the oversimplifications that they are. But increasingly, I think, we seem to be carrying on moral arguments by cliché. Let me give some more serious examples here. In a recent article by the nationally syndicated columnist Ben Wattenberg, Wattenberg taught, and he admitted this was a cliché, he said that one of the great clichés that drives American politics is the little phrase, "not on my watch," not on my watch. And then he used that as a way of making an argument for granting aid to the Contras. In other words, he was saying that that Reagan is driven by this cliché that he doesn't want to surrender one square inch of territory to the communists during Reagan's watch. Now, a complex situation that requires a very subtle foreign policy is reduced to a simple aphorism, "not on my watch." A recent letter to the Greenville News in South Carolina argued against censorship of pornography in upstate South Carolina. We're having all kinds of issues about this. Well, the writer made a kind of a presentation, but the real clincher of his argument was this: the essence of morality is the ability to choose. The essence of morality is the ability to choose. Now, there's something very seductive about that. Apparently, morality has nothing to do with what we choose. It's simply a matter of having the choice. Or recently expressing his opposition to abortion, President Reagan stated, "I don't think that I'm trying to do something that is taking a privilege away from womanhood, because I don't think that womanhood should be considering murder a privilege." Now, I personally have great difficulty with abortion, but this kind of rhetoric is certainly no substitute for responsible moral argument. Now, let me say a little bit about the meaning of the word cliché. I have a real fondness for etymologies, and I always enjoy it in my classes when I can come up to a word and there's some, you can give a little etymology of it. One of my favorites, when I come to the word cosmos, when I teach New Testament, which of course basically means world in the sense of an ordered universe. And I like to tell my students, particularly those young co-eds that spent 5 hours getting themselves beautiful in the morning, that the word cosmetic comes from cosmos and literally means to bring order from chaos. The etymologies can sometimes really illuminate what words mean. Well, now, the word cliché is a word of French origin that in French literally means stereotype. In other words, it refers in its most literal fashion to the metal plate that is made of a picture or a diagram that you can then use to print 1,000 copies of this picture or whatever. Now, this is kind of revealing because a stereotype is not a true representation of reality. It's a distortion. It's backwards. Sort of like if you get a slide in the projector backwards. And if it doesn't have any writing in it, you know, you may not recognize it, but as soon as you get a sign in there and the lettering is backwards, you know that you've got it in. But another thing about a stereotype is that it's fixed. And so, you know, the idea of a cliché taken from this kind of its literal meaning in the French kind of suggests that behind a cliché, this little trite phrase or expression, is a standardized mental picture that's held in common by members of a group and represents a distorted, oversimplified opinion or an uncritical judgment about something. A cliché, in other words, kind of points to a self-evident truth, a particular way of framing the issues and posing the questions that is beyond dispute, that's beyond question. It's fixed. Hence, it means being locked into one pattern of thought, bound to a specific constellation of ideas and assumptions about the way things are. Now, clichés have their origins, I think, in our natural human craving for order and security. Now, if you have an 11-year-old son, you may wonder if there is any natural human craving for order. But the order that I'm speaking of here is order of a more basic sort. It's tied to life's basic questions. We assume, partly because we want to assume, that the world can be understood by us, at least partially. And if we can understand the world, then we can make the world work for us. We can develop little strategies that we can become. We try to discover, for example, the strategies that will lead to wealth, to power, to fame, and we want to also know what's going to lead to failure or poverty or misery or anonymity, so that we can avoid that kind of behavior. Clichés, I think, are a natural reflection of this propensity for order and security. There's obvious security in wrapping reality neatly in easy-to-remember proverbs and aphorisms. Now, one more etymology. The word ethic has an interesting history. It comes from a Greek word, ethos, which originally referred to the stall in which animals were kept. In other words, your horses or cows or sheep or whatever. And the basic idea was that the stall protected. It protected the animals from the weather, from theft, from heat or cold or rain or whatever. And then at some point, the word came to refer to the habits of society that gave order to things. Now, the word ethic, then, is also very directly related to this human craving for order. Anytime we find ourselves in a situation in which we don't know what's expected of us, we get very anxious. Now, 20 years ago, when a woman and I approached a door at the same time, I knew exactly what was expected of me. But since then, things are not always that clear. And what may be, on my part, a polite gesture, for some would be taken as a chauvinistic act. At Furman, I pretty well know my way around now. Now that's not saying that that the changes are bad. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, I think there probably was more than a little chauvinism in the kind of chivalry that particularly we in the South, I guess, try to perpetuate or something. And so now, when it's sort of whoever gets to the door first, regardless of whether it's a man or a woman. But in the kind of transition period, the point I want to make is that when these kind of expectations are not clear, then we get anxious about it. Now, the desire to simplify is certainly not bad. It's often convenient and necessary to oversimplify an idea or a theme. For example, Newton's three laws of motion are actually a special case, and hence an oversimplification of Einstein's theory of relativity. But what grade school teacher is going to begin with E equal mc squared? Or suppose that we insisted that our doctors use their technical jargon instead of layman's terms to explain why we're sick. Few of us would probably understand. So cliches can serve a positive function, helping us to understand at our level what we might not otherwise grasp. But the problem with cliches is that they stop with the first part of Whitehead's axiom. Seek simplicity. And I think one of the differences between what I want to call moral cliches on the one hand and Christian ethics on the other is that Christian ethic seeks simplicity but also mistrusts it. And I think this is a very biblical notion, and I'm going to try to show why that's the case. Now, let me talk a little bit about why cliches are dangerous. Cliches are dangerous when they become isolated, twisted, and absolutized. Cliches usually begin as short little proverbs that contain a truth. Cervantes defined proverbs as short sayings based on long experience containing a truth. So a proverb is like a little lens that helps us to see one little part of reality clearly. But just as I have a number of different lenses with my camera, a wide angle, a telephoto, one of those, you know, the wide angle can give me one view of reality, but in doing that, it's going to distort parts of it. In the same way, if I focus on the wildflower, I'm not going to get the panoramic view of the streams in the valleys. So, we need to remember that we need a number of lenses to get a whole picture. I've used the word proverb here. The collection of proverbs in the Old Testament offers numerous examples of complementary truth. For example, in Proverbs 10:4, you read, "A slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich." Now, this contains the rather obvious truth that laziness often does lead to poverty and industry to wealth, and taken by itself, it carries the subtle suggestion that righteousness is coincident with riches. But that conclusion is corrected by another proverb, for example, 28:6, "Better is a poor man who walks in his integrity than a rich man who is perverse in all his ways." Or in Proverbs 26, you have a rather interesting paradoxical juxtaposition. One says, "Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself." And then that's followed with the compliment, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. In other words, truth is found in the paradox of those. I recall one of my seminary teachers, Henley Barnett, very stately, generous man who taught ethics. And someone asked him one day, said, "Dr. Barnett," said, "don't you think that ultimate truth is always paradoxical?" And he stroked his little goatee a little bit, and he said, "Well, yes and no." Now, the point is that a cliche virtually always encapsulates some aspect of truth. And that's why they have such a powerful appeal. But cliches are dangerous for a second reason. They're so easily twisted for our own selfish ends. Because they contain an element of truth, they become convenient tools of self-deception, cloaking our self-interest with moral justification. Reinhold Niebuhr never tired of reminding us that our capacity for self-deception is incredible. We live in the paradoxical tension of acting in our own self-interest, often at the expense of others, but convincing ourselves at the same time that we're following universal moral principles. Clichés, in other words, enable us to apparently have our cake and eat it too. We use clichés to sanctify self-interest and thereby hide our baseness from ourselves and hopefully from others. For example, in the church, our concern for spiritual things may be a way of escaping the demands of stewardship with material possessions. Or the businessman who's always arguing, "Well, I've got to make a profit," can very easily turn that into moral justification for pure greed. Or even the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself can be twisted for selfish ends, because in a lot of things I read, increasing attention seems to be focused on the concluding phrase, "as yourself," and therefore I'm going to give myself all these things. And it almost becomes a kind of biblical warrant for self-indulgence. Now, this preoccupation with clichés and the inevitable tendency to isolate and absolutize them and to cloak our self-interest in them leads to two unfortunate consequences. Clichés give the illusion of self-righteousness and self-sufficiency, and they lead us into thinking that we know and understand more than we actually do. Clichés should suggest that truth is self-evident, and we forget our partial, finite, self-interested perspective. We fail to see that the cliché distorts even as it illuminates some aspect of reality. And hence, armed with self-evident truth, we feel confident, even duty-bound, to impose our truth on others. And conflict becomes inevitable, for our opponents are committed to opposing clichés, and when both sides become intransigent, violence usually erupts. A second consequence of these kinds of clichés, and one closely related to the first, is that clichés shut off debate prematurely and stifle the search for creative solutions. I had a friend who in the middle 60s was an engineer and worked for IBM. And they gave him a project when he got there of designing an electromagnetic deflection system for the little alphabet generators that you hook up to a computer. Now most of our computers are hooked into little televisions, little monitors. But in 1965, that kind of interfacing had not been done. And so anyway, he took the project, and it turned out to be a pretty bare of a project. And he asked one of his supervisors, you know, why did you give this to me? I mean, just coming out of college. And the supervisor said, well, all the people that have worked here think it's impossible. But he wasn't supposed to know that. And so eventually they, you know, got around to doing it, because all computers now have these little television readouts. So when we become locked into a cliche, this kind of stifles the search for more creative solutions. And this is nowhere more true, I think, than in economic debates. We are locked into a view of the world that puts capitalism over here and communism over here, and it's either or. And it's almost to the point, if one criticizes the United States, that's automatically seen by some people as somehow condoning the Russian system. And so, you know, somehow we need to find a way to break down these kind of self-evident truths the way we look at these. Now, let me mention a couple of biblical things. The whole Bible is involved in the task of destroying cliches, particularly when these cliches separate human beings from God and from each other. If you look, for example, I've already quoted a little bit from the book of Proverbs. There are two other books in the Old Testament that are classified as wisdom writings. Now, the book of Proverbs is fairly conservative. It gives a very ordered picture of the world. There are a few exceptions. But boy, Ecclesiastes and Job, I mean, come along and just eradicate and attack, subvert the kind of ordered perspective that you have in Proverbs. Recent work that has been done on the parables of Jesus suggests that the parables of Jesus are subversive, in that they are designed to kind of get behind people's defenses and to challenge the stereotypes that they have of the world, of God, of human beings, of salvation. Think of a parable for a minute as a word picture that becomes a mirror or a window. Now, probably one of the best examples of a mirror parable is the one that Nathan tells to David after David has committed adultery with Bathsheba and sent Uriah back to the front lines to get killed. And remember, Nathan comes in, and David, of course, is the king. Now, Nathan comes in, and he doesn't confront David head on. He doesn't say, you lousy adulterer and murderer. But he tells David a story. And the story goes something like this. He said, there was a man, a very rich man, who had a whole flock of sheep. And he had a visitor one night. But instead of killing one of his own sheep, he went over and killed the one little ewe lamb that his poor neighbor owned. And boy, David got all mad. You know, the man who has done this thing deserves to die. And Nathan said, you are the man. Now, to David's credit, David saw himself in that mirror. And the tradition is that he wrote Psalm 51, the greatest of the penitential psalms, I guess, on that occasion. Now, Jesus' parables sort of function in the same way. The parable of the prodigal son, for example, in Luke 15, is set in the context of the Pharisees criticizing Jesus' associations with the tax collectors and sinners. That's the opening of chapter 15. And the parable of the prodigal son, you might say in a way, is Jesus' apology, his defense of that. Now, the parable of the prodigal son functions in the first half as a kind of window, and in the second half as a mirror. Now, I think I can assume that you know the parable of the prodigal son. But let's think for a minute, what kind of cliches that Jesus is trying to break down with that. Now, you know the story. A father had two sons, and the younger one comes up and says, "Father, give me the share of inheritance that is coming to me." And the father complied, and the son gathered all that he had. Literally, he liquidated his assets and took off for the far country. He squandered it and finally gets a job tending pigs. He's a swineherd. Now, some work by Norman Perrin has thrown some interesting light on this whole idea of a swineherd. Now, all of you know how the Jews feel about pork. I mean, there you go. But in the Mishnah of the second century, there was a class of about six occupations that were considered to be, when a person engaged in that occupation, they were considered to be beyond the possibility of God's grace. These seven occupations, I'm not sure, but there were the prostitutes, the tax collectors, the pigeon flyers. Now, don't ask me about that one. I'm not. Traffickers in seventh-year produce. If you know anything about the covenant codes in the Old Testament, every seventh year you were to let your land lie fallow. And there was a real temptation to cheat on that. And so you were outcast. Another category of these outcasts were the shepherds. First time I read that, I couldn't believe it, because of the tradition of the shepherd kings. But by the first century, the whole image of shepherd had changed. And so it's a pretty radical note in the second chapter of Luke, when Luke tells us that the first witnesses to the birth of Jesus were shepherds. We tend to kind of romanticize the shepherds, but not for the Pharisees. And of course, the swineherds and dice throwers and usurers. And of course, back then, usury meant not simply collecting exorbitant interest, but collecting interest, period, on your money. So when Jesus says, you know, this guy becomes a swineherd, everybody's thinking, well, he has disgraced the family name. There is no possibility that he can come to salvation. But then Jesus, paints the picture of the father who's looking out the window and runs out to meet the son when he returns. Incidentally, the son knows that he has squandered his inheritance. I mean, he says, I'll go back as a servant, and I'll be better off as a servant than staying here. But the father welcomes him back as a son. He gives him a robe. He gives him a ring, probably a signet ring with a kind of family seal on it, and gives him shoes, one of the things that distinguished the free man and the slave in the ancient world was the fact that free men had shoes. Remember the black spiritual, when we all get to heaven, all God's children are going to have shoes. The point of the parable kind of turns on the point that if a human parent, a human father, can overcome social convention to the point of welcoming back such a wayward son, then surely God can do that. In other words, the parable becomes a kind of window that a kind of window in the middle of their hardened way of looking at God and how God is related to human beings, and they get a glimpse of something beyond that which they see. Now, the second part of the parable, you have the story of the elder brother, who really gets ticked off about this party that he finds is being thrown for his wayward brother, and I think that part of the parable is intended to be a kind of mirror. Just as the elder brother resists welcoming the younger son, his brother, back into the family, the Pharisees are resisting welcoming the tax collectors and sinners back into the community of Israel. It's interesting that that parable, unlike some of the others, does not end with any kind of statement of judgment. It's almost as if that parable is kind of left open-ended, as if there's a kind of invitation extended to the Pharisees to change the way they think about God and about human beings and about just how broad and deep God's mercy is. I want to give us plenty of time to talk here. I think there are several that we could have chosen other parables to make a very similar point, but the point is the fact that the Bible chooses stories and parables. In fact, the Bible is a story as well as a collection of stories. That this might give us some clues about how we as a community, both individuals as a group, can deal with some of our own blind spots. My whole graduate education was sort of based on the idea that to be a good theologian, you had to be a good philosopher. I don't think that's true anymore. Because I think religious language is far closer to the language of the poet and the musician and the storyteller than it is to philosophy.
I'd like to solve problems entirely different way than they are. I don't seem to have anyone listening to me.
That is a question that bugs me very deeply. And I don't know if you've looked at the whole schedule, but on Friday I'm going to be talking about sustaining moral vigor in a morally ambiguous world, one of the real struggles that I find myself having is sustaining precisely that kind of hope. And so, and what I want to do on Friday is, you know, what are the resources within the Christian tradition for sustaining a kind of hope that indeed things can be changed when it seems that the little work we do seems to be... What's kind of behind your question? Is it
well, thinking of Central America,
yeah,
and particularly Mexico,
mm-hmm,
I hear the fears that the conservatives are talking about, and I understand that.
Yeah.
And I feel we could have done so much more with love. And I know it sounds naive, but I think if we had spent a few of the billions a few years ago pouring into schools and medical facilities and helping with land reform, if we could, etc., in Nicaragua,
mm-hmm,
we could have shown them that, yes, the United States cares about us, cares about our people, and I think we should be doing the same thing in Mexico now. And I understand that we have their government to those countries are not,
mm-hmm,
what we'd like and ideal, but I think some tangible help should come in other forms than arms.
Mm-hmm.
I teeter on a simple, is she done? Sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to add something to what she's saying, and that is that I teeter between thinking of it as a deliberate way to keep an arms factory open so we can have jobs, so we can keep our own people somewhat happy.
Mm-hmm.
I teeter that way one time, and then I think, oh, no, we wouldn't be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to believe that our country has moral people at the helm.
Mm-hmm.
So then that comes down to the lowest common denominator, and the bottom line is money.
Mm-hmm.
As a motive. But I know it's more complex.
Mm-hmm. You know what you point. I mean, the kind of question you bring up about teetering, leaning this way and that way. The sociologists talk a lot about what they call plausibility structures. What seems to be plausible. When we find ourselves in one group, we may find very implausible when we have kind of identified with another group for a while. And so, you know, one of the ways, I think, of sustaining, some kind of hope here in your case and in trying to deal with this kind of teetering is to, is to have a community that, in other words, we as individuals, we cannot sustain it, I think. That it has to come from a community of people. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer has a fine little book called Life Together, which was written out of his experiences with the underground seminary in the early part of the Nazi era in Germany. And he talks about the necessity of the community, that on days when he was in despair, there would be someone else who could lift him up, and then there would be other days when he could. So I think that it's certainly no accident that the biblical story is not an individual story, but it is the story of a people. And it's both of Israel and then, of course, in the New Testament, the church. And I think it's only in some kind of communal context like that that one can indeed sustain any kind of hope, as well as sustaining a realistic assessment of what indeed is going on. Now, that doesn't mean all groups or communities do that, because, communities can have their blind spots as well. But, so that's a partial answer, maybe.
Joe?
Yeah?
I appreciate the simplicity of your description of these things that I mistrusted. it seems to me that you've labeled cliché what is, in fact, a variety of different examples. I think the clearest one are slogans. Mm-hmm. Many of your examples were what I would call slogan. They don't embody a truth, rather they're shorthand for a larger argument. In fact, that's often where we get into problems, is not with the cliché which embodies the truth, but rather we trade slogans without ever examining the arguments for which the slogans stand.
Mm-hmm.
I also mistrust the argument some because human beings, being finite creatures, have to deal with simplification.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have mental shorthand. If we have to explain what we really meant with everything that we said, the conversation certainly would never appear on the evening news. It'd be too long. And we would have trouble even discussing things with people. I assume what you're aiming at is it's getting beyond the slogan to examine the underlying arguments that, for which the slogan stands, and being willing to go beyond the slogan.
Yeah, it may be that cliche can't carry as much weight as I want to put on it. With the little etymology there, I was trying to suggest that that what really is significant here is what is behind the cliche, which is a kind of fixed, distorted picture of the world that is unquestioned and is, you know, is not looked at critically at all. Maybe cliche is not a good choice of words. Now, I thought I've at least made the point too that we do have a craving for order, and that because we are finite, partial creatures, we do need simplicity. But it does seem to me that a part of maturity, both, I mean, simply as adults and as Christians, I mean, put away childish things, that a part of that is recognizing that my truth is only a part of the truth, and that it seems to me that one of the virtues of Christian faith ought to be one of intellectual humility, which is an acknowledgement that I don't have all the truth. And here I'm very much persuaded by Reinhold Niebuhr's rather paradoxical statement that is anything but simplistic, that Christianity is most true precisely at the point at which it admits that it doesn't have the whole truth. So it seems to me that yes, we need order, and we need simplicity. We need our cliches. But at the same time, we need to acknowledge and be open to the distortions that those cliches bring to us. So how would you, is that a satisfactory response? Or?
I mean, we probably should bring other people in. But no, it seems to me that we need to examine often the complex of ideas underlying certain slogans.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have to simplify a lot of things so that we can focus in on that one area. Mm-hmm. If you take something like Central America, the have to stop communism or not online watch. That is a shorthand for a whole argument.
Sure.
And
sure.
A whole series of assumptions that need to be examined. I don't see how there's any truth embodied in not online watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's a slogan.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, then in other words, that I was not always consistent. That in other words, that some. I think I did say at one point that cliches usually begin as little proverbs that do contain a truth. Okay, I see what you're saying. I will accept that as a criticism. I need to. Perhaps refine the way I use cliche. Yeah.
I'm perfectly comfortable with the idea that cliche is a very simplified way of expressing probably a very complex situation. And you brought several different examples, all probably from a particular persuasion, one that I think I would agree with, generally speaking. But I think we need to, at least I do, to think further to realize that we may condemn, so to speak, yeah, the use of cliches and the simplification, the simplicity situation on one direction if it's used by people for causes that we're not interested in. When we turn around and for a cause that we are interested in, we try to reduce it to a cliche very quickly. And I think we all work with cliches for a particular cause. Causes, if they agree with us, then they're good. If they don't, then they're too simple and they're bad.
Okay, in other words, I can be faulted for sort of picking my examples from the right wing, whereas one finds cliches and oversimplifications equally on the left. I think you're right.
So we all need to examine, even if we agree with our particular cause and cliches that come from it, the idea that if they're too simple, then maybe we should not mistrust them, but at least think them through further than accept them just the beginning.
Okay. What about some of the rest of it? Yeah, over here.
Maybe what I'm saying is parallel to Ms. Jones' comment, but I see one thing that's frightening to me and most people in society is the volume and the growth of knowledge. So with every 10 years, human knowledge doubles. So it seems to me as we get more knowledgeable as a species, our poor little brains can't keep up. And I think we're forced to go to cliches. Mm-hmm. What I see in the fundamentalist religious movement with the bumper sticker, the Bible says that that settles that kind of thing. People are just overwhelmed with the theology and the Niebuhr and all the literature for the ages. And so they give up and go down to just the, I created the world in 7 days, and that's it. I don't want to hear anything about my Darwin and stuff. And I think this is a trend that's happening. Mm-hmm. I don't know, some way I when I hear you talk about it, I think maybe it's scary because maybe you're starting to push the river. The river is back towards cliches because that's what we can handle. Mm-hmm. We evolve into something bigger brain there.
Yeah, I just read just a couple of weeks before coming here an article by Nancy Ammerman of Emory, which is based on a study she has done of the fundamentalist, and what you said is exactly one of the points that she makes, that people are simply overwhelmed by both the complexity of modern life and the rapidity of change, and that as a way of trying to cope with that, they find comfort in a very simple order such as they get in fundamentalism. And also, a part of fundamentalism is having somebody, a pastor or some kind of leader, to tell you exactly what you need. In other words, you don't need to expend any energy trying to sift through this yourself, but you just kind of take it on a platter.
I see that more and more in business too, where the executives, or me as a project manager, I want to get to the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have time. I think this is the base of our design.
Okay. Yeah, here and there.
Well, that has something to do with perhaps dumped everything on the education system, I suppose, but with the way things are done in the education system in this country, where use a cliche, independent thinking is not necessarily encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is easier to just pick up what's floating around in the statements. I think about the taking notes, for example, in college, and a professor, you hear stories of a professor and throws in something every now and then that is absolutely meaningless and everybody busily writes it down.
One way that I think our educational system may kind of push people in this direction is that our education seems to assume that there is always one right answer. In other words, that things tend to be based upon convergent kind of thinking instead of divergent thinking. And so I think when we're trained that way, we find ourselves, it's much easier to kind of be seduced by cliches, that you can kind of wrap it up like that. I don't know if that's a good statement or not. Let's see.
I recently had Commissioner's book, Space, and he talked about the reaction, that after all the euphoria of man on the moon and all that, that there tended to be a real letdown, and then people were really resisting science because there'd been such an emphasis on it, and it was way beyond anybody's understanding. Hmm. And that these things tend to go in cycles, and they're sort of a fundamental back to the basics. Don't bother with all these scientific things.
Yeah. Now, who wrote that?
James Michener.
James Michener. Okay, I haven't seen that. Helen?
I do think that we're at an age that's just flooded by information, more information than we can handle. And we have a natural desire for simplicity, but I think that the times that I find most life-giving aren't when I say, I'm glutted with information, just tell me if the Social Security system's going to fail or not, so I'll know if I should invest. Mm-hmm. Just tell me if I need the operation, don't make me decide between the alternatives. The most life-giving times for me are when I go beyond the cliche, I just can't do that, and I try, and I really learn something. Or, you know, it's simple for a lot of women from my age of trying to do something that requires physical fitness, you know, or just simple things. When we really challenge ourselves to some complexity, and we can really begin to understand the fabric of what we're thinking about. I mean, I can't run races now, but I can begin to understand what's involved in that. Or you can begin to understand what homelessness is about when you make yourself go to the soup kitchen and dish up soup for 4 weeks. So I think that it's a natural desire to stick to what we know and to look for simple answers, but I really think that we're called to try and wrestle with the complexity. And it's a very life-giving thing to do.
Yeah, to come back to one of the points I was trying to make is that it's not simply a case of not knowing, or even sometimes not wanting to know, but a case of refusing to know. I mean, there's a kind of willed ignorance, I think, that really gets. We got time for probably one more. Okay, since you had a turn, we'll let take this.
As you mentioned, world ignorance, it was speaking from a thought I was having about coming out of a relatively fundamentalist background where there were many cliches. We put, I thought, God in a box. Mm-hmm. Everything had a nice little answer. And there was no way to stretch world question, whatever way you want to put it, because you were going against God. Not just a way of thought, but God. And that was, that's real scary. Thus I see that in any form of fundamentalism, whether it be in Christianity, Judaism, Islam, whatever it is, very hard for that to change, to grow, for people to break away, because they're not only changing their tradition, they're moving away from their God as they conceive mm-hmm. him or her. And that is about the most threatening thing I think one can do.
Right. Well, thank you for your contributions. And.